Who cares about sequels? We're just going to forget all that stuff that happened in the middle and go right to a sequel reboot. I don't know. I don't care. All I'm happy about is that we finally have a movie that shows podcasters what for. We're watching Halloween, the 2018 version. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to your new favorite podcast. My name is Drew, and this is The More You Nerd, where we are talking about some franchise frights this Halloween season. And boy, are we ending on a high point. The 2018 film called Halloween, which serves as a direct sequel to the 1978 film called Halloween, and ignores all of the other Halloween this and that's in the middle. But of course, I can't do it by myself. I need the Dr. Loomis to my weird doctor in this movie whose name I can't remember. Miles, how are you, my friend?
I'm doing great, bud. You can't not have a Halloween movie. I think a Halloween movie has to be present any Halloween. This is a movie that I have watched pretty regularly since it came out, but I watch both Halloween 1 and 4 every single fall, because the opening shots of Halloween 4 are like the epitome of fall vibes. And then Halloween's one of my favorite movies of all time, so it's the time of year. Every Halloween I watch it.
Yeah, well, and I will say, and the reason that we did this, I know we talked about this a little bit last week, is I have only seen the first Halloween, and I think I've watched it for the first time last year or 2 years ago.
It was 2 years ago, I think.
I can't remember specifically when, because time has no meaning anymore. But so when you suggested this one, I didn't even have to ask. You're like, and no, this ignores all of the other sequels that have taken place.
It is the prime reason. All you have to have seen is the first one. It even ignores two, which had for a long time been part of every canon aside from the remake era. So the first remake era.
Yeah. So of the Halloween films, there's Halloween, Halloween 2, Halloween 3, Season of the Witch, Halloween 4, The Return of Michael Myers, Halloween 5, The Revenge of Michael Myers, Halloween, The Curse of Michael Myers, one that I definitely remember happening at the time, but never watching, Halloween H2O, 20 years later, Halloween Resurrection, and then back in August of 2007, Halloween, and then Halloween 2, and now Halloween. And of course, this film has two sequels as well, including one that came out just a couple years ago. But
typically Halloween likes to ignore everything outside of the first two films. When H2O came out, it ignored Halloween 4, 5, and 6. And initially, when this movie was being written, they were going to ignore everything except for the first two again, but decided to throw it out. And just, what if the night ended that night? And the logical conclusion does happen. The police catch Michael Myers that night.
Yeah.
And I think that's what makes this story a really fun place to start, because, you know, they've already tried to reboot things with an older Laurie before, with H2O. Which I was kind of surprised you had never seen. Just like that was a pretty popular movie that came out. I knew groups always went to see stuff together like that. So
Miles, you've known me for so long.
I know, but still, you come up with some things from the 90s where I'm like, I would not have called that.
Look, I am a walking contradiction when it comes to certain things that I claim to like and not like. So that's fair.
Right,
that's fair. It's like, Drew, you don't like horror stuff. No, but you've played every Resident Evil game hours on end.
You know, right.
I don't know what I don't know what my deal is. So let's get into this movie. Halloween, I will say, I understand why they called it Halloween. It's the 30th anniversary. It does, on some basic level, bother me. 40th anniversary.
Yeah.
I thought they said 30 years ago in the movie, but no, it must have been 40.
They said 40.
Time has no meaning. I should know that it was 40 because it's pretty close to our age.
It's exactly our age. What are you talking about? We had a whole month about this.
Yeah, but it's from 2018. So that would have been its 40. So it's like, it's getting up to 45. I can't wait till we have great grandmother Jamie Lee Curtis as Laurie Strode in the next decade. That'll be fun. But yeah, so this film introduces us to a lot of different things. So we have Laurie returning. Well, I guess the whole framing of this, at least at first, spoiler warning for this movie, by the way, this framing doesn't last particularly long because of some events. But we are introduced to two true crime podcasters, and this might be the first movie that we have watched for this show especially that features podcasters as a main story element.
Did we do Ghostbusters Afterlife together?
Wait, is that the most recent one? We watched this.
No.
We did watch Afterlife, but I don't. Oh, but yeah, the kid did have a podcast in that. You're right. Yeah, I forgot about
podcast.
That. His name is Podcast. Okay, I take it back. and they are basically doing a true crime podcast investigating these murders, the Michael Myers murders from 40 years ago, and they're going to where he is being kept. And weirdly, you'd never get a real direct look at his face, but you get pretty good looks of who this guy is. Which I was interested in, and I don't know whether that's a Halloween thing. If they ever did in the first movie either.
So this film was written by David Gordon Green, Danny McBride. And they both loved the first film, and they said they wanted to make a film that felt grounded in reality, because in the reality of the film, no matter how John Carpenter framed it, the idea is this guy is a person. And so they wanted to like come back to that idea of like, what would make you more afraid to take out your trash at night? You know, the idea of some supernatural boogeyman that you can easily displace, or the fact that a real life person that you've seen on the news, it might be out there beyond the, you know, the line of sight of your home in the dark. What's scarier? And I liked that approach of like, okay, we've done a lot of supernatural Michael Myers. Let's rein it back and make it a tad more like the original, where yes, John Carpenter's intention is more to demystify him. And that's what's so great about that movie. But if you're going to follow up 40 years later and do something a little different, I kind of like taking that a little bit out of the equation.
And this is something that I paused to look up some actors, because I recognized people in this movie and I was like, who is that? And I noticed something interesting that they only really reference one time in the film, is that Michael Myers does not have a credit in this movie. Both of the actors that portray him, I think there's one that portrays him outside of the mask and one that portrays him inside of the mask. They're both called The Shape.
Yes. And that is how he's credited in the original Halloween.
Is he? Interesting. Yes. I did not know that. Ah.
So the Shape is Michael's like fun nickname that is known to people. Like, he's often referred to in like, if people are writing stuff about Halloween, as The Shape. It is the preferred term. It's not credited that way, I think, after 2. But I believe Nick Castle, the original Michael, is one of the suit actors in this.
Nick Castle is he is one of the suit actors. I honestly thought he might be the one that was at the
there was one young guy and then an older guy. Like the other guy playing Michael, I don't think is very old at all.
No, and I think he's, you know, they're both big dudes. But
fun fact about Nick Castle. Yes, he's Michael Myers. Also wrote Escape from New York.
Interesting.
With John Carpenter. Yeah.
I love Escape from New York. That's great. But yeah, but I thought that was interesting, especially as they dip their toe just a little bit into the psychology of it, because Laurie has been referring to him as the boogeyman for 40 years.
Which in the film is how she knows him. So like she wouldn't refer to him as the shape, but she would refer to him as the boogeyman. That's a big part of that first movie.
But I think she sees him at some point and calls him the shape or something like that early on in the film. I seem to have clocked that, but I don't remember. It's okay. Doesn't really matter. But of course, Laurie, we have to talk about, has been Sarah Connoring the past 40 years. She's been getting in shape. She's been gearing up. She's been, you know, setting traps and.
Yeah. I think the idea to make Laurie more of a survivalist was a great choice because one, we had already seen Jamie Lee Curtis return in H2O. Doing a very similar thing that it had ignored the 4 through 6, and you do get the insinuation that she did have a drinking problem, but she is the dean or a person in charge of a boarding school that her son goes to, and so like there's all these hints that she's had some episodes, but like it's all like kind of like, you know, oh, she hadn't taken her medication, blah blah blah. In this one, they forego any idea of a successful life. Like, yes, she's divorced in the prior one, but like she has her stuff together. Laurie does not have her stuff together here. And that was what Jamie Lee Curtis had said really drew her in, is like, oh, this really talks about Laurie's trauma. And coming from that angle really interested her to return to the project, because she wanted to, you know, add some depth to the Laurie character. And I do think they completely succeeded here. I think that Laurie is really fascinating in this movie.
Laurie is really fascinating, and seeing her relationship with her daughter and granddaughter, played her daughter Karen, played by Judy Greer, and her granddaughter Allison, played by Andy Matichak, I don't know.
I believe that's how it's pronounced.
Is a really interesting dichotomy, because Karen has clearly, due to trauma, and we learned that she was taken away from her mom at 12. They did not reconnect until years later, and even then their relationship has been very distant. We learned throughout the course of the movie that she was basically raised in this realm of fear and always watching your back and always being ready and learning to shoot a gun when you're 6 years old or whatever age she said it was.
I think she's 8.
As we sort of get a glimpse of the what we're going to really see in action at the end of the film. But she has also gone into psychology. She seems to be a psychologist, which is very interesting.
I was just saying, pretty on the nose.
Yeah, I don't want to speak out of turn, but I know a couple of psychologists that went into psychology to try to figure out their own stuff.
and that is the impression that you get from
Karen. Yeah,
I always forget her name's Karen. Partially because no one ever says it. I hear being called mom mostly throughout the movie.
The only person that really calls her Karen is Laurie screaming it.
Right.
But I
also love that we have this continuing trend of comedians or known comedic actors in serious roles, because I mean, the entire time I'm waiting for her to tell Michael, say goodbye to these.
What's hilarious is that I watched this movie, and then later on the same day, I was watching some Arrested Development to pass time while my kid was at a soccer practice, and that episode of Arrested Development came on, and I just was like, ah, how convenient.
Yeah. And then you know who her husband is, right?
Toby Huss. How could I not know who?
Artie, the strongest man in the world.
Granted, saying that Toby Huss is known as Artie the strongest man in the world is really an insult to his incredible career.
Not only that, it's a super niche thing at this point.
Yeah.
P&P was such an important part for like a specific like sliver of a generation, because any further before or after, they have no idea.
Yeah. Now, but Toby Huss is a well-known both comedic and serious actor. He's done a lot more serious stuff lately, but he's been a voice actor for a long time. A lot of voices on King of the Hill, which for all we know, he might be doing King of the Hill again as the King of the Hill relaunch maybe announced at any moment. But that's another story altogether. The whole setup is that Laurie is kind of weird and standoffish and stays locked up in her house. Her daughter Karen is just trying to raise her daughter Allison, who Allison clearly has some affection for her grandmother, likely because she didn't grow up the way that her mom did.
Well, yeah, there is certainly that kind of aspect, especially when you find out that you have like a family member that you may not have thought you had, like, I didn't know I had a grandma, you know, and that can have an effect on, you know, especially if she's been around for maybe like 3 or 4 years. So Alice maybe might have been 10.
They don't really say when they reconnected.
They don't say when, but like, I mean, you have to think it's not too far away, but also far away enough for enough that like a kid would want to have a relationship with this like slated relative.
Yeah.
So like, I feel like it's got to be around there.
Yeah. But we see all of their kind of, Allison is, you know, getting into the National Honor Society and, you know, she keeps wanting her grandma to come to her events, but her mom isn't telling her about them. But she's going around her mom's back and contacting Laurie directly. And there's just a lot of very obvious family drama and Laurie's pretty profound drinking problem that she clearly has. But all of this is couched with Laurie's worst fears coming to light, in that Michael is being transferred facilities. And of course he's being transferred facilities on Halloween. And well, I guess it's the day before, technically the night before.
Yeah. It's technically the day before, which is something that does happen in the Halloween sequels, where like Michael is going towards Haddonfield, you know, at least on the 29th or the 30th, but by the 31st, he is there to cause trouble.
I mean, it's the Friday the 13th movie is always happening on Friday the 13th.
It's the name of the film. I mean, yeah.
And of course, the bus that he is on crashes because he, you know, freaks out and kills people. And we don't see any of that on screen. We just see the aftermath of it. And then sort of all hell breaks loose.
Except for one death. Where I was kind of this is where like a lot of people got surprised. Michael murders a child.
Yeah, that was a weird one. So so he does murder a child. Granted, this kid's maybe 14, which, you know, maybe 13.
I know what you're trying to say, but like he is depicted as being a little bit younger.
Yeah.
Like he certainly is. If he's 14, he's the runt of the area 14-year-olds.
Kid just wanted to go to dance class too. Golly. Mm-hmm. But yeah, child murder on screen. Although, to be fair, Miles, he does not kill a baby later in the same movie.
Well, I think that whole death happened is so that the audience would question is this going to happen?
Is he going to kill this baby?
And it's also in one of the best sequences of the entire film. That single shot of Haddonfield and Michael kind of causing chaos, but the it never cutting, it is phenomenal. That's like one of my favorite parts of the movie.
So I loved that part of the movie. I also loved when after the prison bus breakout, and for the next few scenes, as people learn about it and, you know, Laurie's figuring it all out and et cetera, et cetera, you're watching stuff happen and you're just seeing little flashes of people in white suits in the background.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just so cool because it's like, and like you walk by and you just see a white suit slamming down like behind a window in a store. It's a really, really powerful.
Yes. So you're talking about the sequence at the gas station.
Yeah.
And yeah, the podcasters have parked. The girl needs to go to the bathroom. They're getting gas. And at the same time, Michael is there. And you see it through the peripheral of the camera or in the background, but not in focus. And it's something that happens a lot in this movie where the camera is a voyeur, but it's not an intimate one. Yeah. So you're still watching in the same spot. And I don't know, some of that makes it scarier, honestly.
I loved it. I thought that stuff worked so well. And then the first time you really see, well, I guess Michael's already killed the kid, but they give you just enough of one of the podcasters in the bathroom when he just comes up and he's like kicking the door open to look for somebody.
To be useless.
And then he's opening the door and then she's got it locked, but he just sticks his hand over the door and drops all these teeth. Like that mm-hmm. is menace. That is wild.
It's so good. It's
they give you just in that whole sequence, especially once the other podcaster gets into the mix. There's a split second where you think these are two of the main characters of this movie that we've met. There is some chance that she is going to get away right here. And it just doesn't happen. And it's
as soon as she takes the crowbar and goes back into the stall,
you know it's over.
Is when you knew, this is it. Let's talk about the podcasters a little bit, because there is something that is super cringe about them, but not in a way that a lot of movies do. Like a lot of movies try to over emphasize like a podcaster being insensitive or annoying, or just being a terminally online person. And I really did enjoy the fact that these two people both felt like exploitive jerks, but also genuinely like interested in their subjects. And like, it felt like a real like NPR, you know, effort.
But there was also this weird moment of anytime he seemed to be the one to cross the lines, like, we want to help you. We want to help you confront your trauma and da 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 da. And it's like, you're a podcaster, dude. You're not a psychologist. You're not, you know, you are a journalist at best, but let's talk about that. And there were moments where he would seem to cross the line and you'd get a little reaction from her, but then they would back each other up, and, you know, and it was telling in that final moment that he's like dying against the wall, watching her get killed before he ultimately succumbs to his own trauma. That was all kind of wrapped up right there. And I don't know. Spoiler warning for the end of this. I really like this movie, Miles. This movie is great. And I'm happy to have seen it.
Yes. Awesome. Okay. So it's super fun to like, there's a lot of references to other Halloween films or sequences. Like, so in H2O, one of Michael's first kind of like post like on the road things is he kind of terrorizes this girl in a bathroom, in like a roadside bathroom, and it's very similar in a little bit to how this scene shakes out, except a lot less violent. One of my favorite sequences in the movie is one of the more obvious ones, and it's a callback to the ending of the first film, when Michael and Laurie are struggling, she falls off the edge of the house and he turns away, looks back, and she's gone.
That was a very good turnaround of
I love it so much. There's so much about this movie that like I think kind of subverts expectations, especially for a horror sequel.
Yeah.
And part of it is a lot of the emotional stuff with Laurie. And I honestly liked all the teen drama too, because of course I did, but I think one of the cool,
the teen drama bothered me.
Of course it did.
Well, it's not that it bothered me.
This is par for the course for both of us.
Well, it's not that it bothered me a lot. It's just that it was built up to be so much more a part of the movie. But
right,
it didn't get paid off. And the one teenage boy that was slightly more likable than the other teenage boy, both of whom were complete D-bags.
Yeah,
he does get killed, but the other worse one doesn't.
Oh, well, give it time.
I'm sure he comes back in a sequel and gets killed.
But, so Halloween Kills takes place on the same night.
Interesting.
Yeah. This movie does not end the way I remembered it, just because I forgot that because Halloween Kills begins with that last scene, there's a little extra, which what helps start the Halloween Kills. But the way they end this movie, I mean, we still haven't even gotten to where, like, Michael's, you know, we haven't gotten the whole why he's crossed paths with Laurie again, you know. So Michael escapes and has his rampage in Haddonfield, and we were introduced to probably one of the best example of a likable babysitter I think I've seen in a while.
Oh, she was great. She was a great babysitter. Vicky was her name. I liked her character
and Julian
so much.
The kid.
Yeah, I liked her character so much. I remembered her name without having to look it up on.
Well, because in a lot of these movies, they give you a babysitter who might be cool, but like just doesn't care that much about the kid, or just they have an antagonistic relationship. Here, you know, they have all of the above, but like you can tell that they both really care about each other, and they're being their age. And I thought that was really, really sweet.
Yeah. I do hate that, there's the jump scare, and then there's the actual jump scare. Like, it's mm-hmm. like she looked throughout the entire room, but she didn't check the closet.
But that one's such a great scene because, like, you expect that jump to be immediate.
Yeah.
You know, that's the setup. And, like, the fact that they build it up to where, like, you might be like, is there just something in the doorway? And yes, there is. It's Michael Myers.
Yeah.
It's an effective use of that kind of scare.
I also like, and again, I don't know enough about, it's been so long since I've seen the first movie, and I don't know enough about the others, that there are some kills that Michael seems to take more pleasure in, and there's others that are just very fast and he moves on. And that's a very interesting dichotomy as well.
I think there's probably more plot driven than
any sort of psychological character examination.
No, not one that's really consistent without the like any breaks. Like there's not something that Michael like always does, other than like the head tilt or something like that. But like it's not like he has an MO.
I do want to say the one thing about the teen stuff that was interesting but also a little infuriating was, of course, Allison has a fight with her boyfriend at the party. Dylan, is that his name? Dylan?
Yeah, I think so.
What a piece of crap.
Yeah, he sucks.
And he takes her phone and throws it into a bowl of pudding.
So I always wonder what that is.
So why there's a bowl of pudding at a dance, I don't know. Two, like,
it could be nacho cheese.
Maybe.
I don't know. Maybe. I don't know what it is. It's goop.
It's some sort of goop, but it's also goop that you could definitely scoop that phone out and wipe it off, and it would be completely fine.
Well, I know. I think she left it for emotional effect, like than anything else. Like she was pissed off, and she's like, "No, I'm just gonna leave."
It does solve the good old fashioned of how do we get rid of a cell phone in this horror movie to raise the stakes, which is,
but, I mean, it does, but it's like, I mean, it just gives you one extra scene of her being found and delivered to her family. So it's not super crazy.
Well, it does give us, some other stuff. So we also have, while Laurie is now on the hunt for Michael Myers in this whole deal, So is this guy named Officer Hawkins, who is on, he's an old time sheriff's deputy or police officer in this town. He was apparently on the team that captured Michael 40 years ago. And I don't remember if that was a thing we saw in the movie at all. Nope. I looked up
it's a flashback sequence in a later movie, but like it's after the events of the Carpenter film.
Yeah, I was going to say, I looked up the actor to see if he had been in any other Halloween movies, and it didn't look like he had. So, so he's on the hunt, but we also have him interacting with Dr. Sartain, who is Michael's new psychiatrist that works in the asylum he's been in. And this is maybe the
looks
part
like of the, Dr. Wiley
a little bit. Yeah. This is maybe the part of the movie that I think is the least earned.
I fully agree. It's the weakest part of the film.
So you get the idea early on that Dr. Sartain seems to have taken special interest in Michael as a patient at the asylum. But once he is there and interacting with Michael, and going around with Officer Hawkins trying to find Michael and urging him not to kill him and not to kill him and not to kill him because he needs to be studied, et cetera, et cetera. Officer Hawkins sees him and runs him down with the car, to which Dr. Sartain proclaims that he's dead. And then when Hawkins comes out to investigate and double check, Sartain pulls like a weird scalpel, whatever that
like extends,
that extendo scalpel weapon, and kills Hawkins right there. Ah, that's what it feels like
about that.
And it's a twist that I feel like it could have been set up slightly better, but you also don't want it to be too obvious. You want it to be a twist. You want it to be a surprise. But I feel like it doesn't land quite where I wanted it to. I don't hate it. I don't think it works as well.
I don't love it. I don't hate it. I'm kind of indifferent. I think that, I mean, one, it's also a nod to Halloween 5 and 6 of a doctor. Again, there are things in this script that like are all like references to the franchise itself, which is why I like this movie so much. Is it really is kind of a love letter to everything Halloween, even though they are purposely only doing one film. I do agree with you that this part is the least baked. It's honestly, it distracts. And I feel like it's only a vehicle to get Andy out of the car and the officers off the table. That's really all it really serves the movie. It's like you have to get Andy from point A to point B quickly, and you also have to have her on
Allison.
The run.
Allison is the character's name.
I'm sorry.
Andy Allison is the actress's name. I was really confused. Like, who is Andy?
I'm sorry.
But,
yeah.
But that's
Andy. Yeah.
But that is another thing where it's like, I expected more of Allison and Karen and Lori being separated, and they're really not separated for that long.
I mean, once the party starts, time was, you know, Allison's pretty separated from everyone through most of the night.
But she's also not in danger at that point. I'm talking like
not until the scene after the party, which has the best needle drop of the entire movie in terms of original music. The I think the actual track is called like the Shape Stalks Allison, and it's the scene where like she sees Michael Myers, and then you hear that little electronic music and then that guitar kick in.
I didn't clock it at the time, but they do.
It's like one of the most known tracks from the score, because everything else is kind of reused from the original. But this is John Carpenter kind of redoing everything. So,
you know who else worked on the music for this movie?
His son.
His son. Yeah. Who is our age? Cody Carpenter.
Yeah. Cody Carpenter. Yeah. No, I have this soundtrack.
Of course,
it's pretty great.
Of course, but all of that gets us to really the final arc of the movie, as we are back in Lori's house, where she has, it's got gates everywhere, it's got lights everywhere. One of the most interesting moments of it, because I think the implication is that Allison has never been here, and just kind of happens upon it. Is that she?
I think I agree with you that I don't know if she's ever been there, but I think she knows where it is.
Well, they were just down the street from it when she ran into the woods. It would be,
yeah,
it wouldn't be too weird to have her stumble upon it. But we have seen Lori's shooting range of mannequins in the yard before, and she stumbles upon it and just freaks out because there's all these mannequins around. And I think there's even like a weird ooh, sound effect or something when she runs across.
I mean, to her credit, it's like dark. And so all you see is a bunch of like weird shapes. And yeah, I can imagine that being really scary.
Yeah. And this is really where the final act begins, as Lori gears up. Ray, who's still around. Ray gets a gun. Karen gets a gun. They've got all the doors locked. They're using the secret under the kitchen basement entrance that's wild.
I love it. I love it so much.
And
last 15 minutes is honestly like the best part of the movie.
And so there's all this fear, because you have Lori, who goes up to fight him by herself, and leaving Karen downstairs by herself because they don't know that Allison is there yet. And you get Lori almost dying because Michael throws his arms through the, well, he kills Ray outside. RIP Ray, you king.
I wanted so much more from him, because I mean, the first time I saw this movie, I was like, oh my God, you know, and I was kind of hoping for something, and nope. Ray dies pretty quickly.
Yeah. But through this, you have Lori, who shoots off part of I almost called him Jason, shoots off part of Michael's hand, and,
which happens to all of them. Like, well, if you're in more than one movie, you're losing some digits.
Yeah. You know, all this stuff happens as she's sort of clearing the house, and you learn that she's got like, oh, she's clears this room, and then she hits a button on the outside of it, and this like door grate comes down. It's like, okay.
Yeah.
What is this about? This is interesting, because it prevents, if there is anybody in there, prevents them from following you. It's very smart moves.
Yeah.
And she does get to, you know, she does end up getting, oh, the mannequin room was creepy. And did mm-hmm. Michael set those mannequins up in that room? Because I don't think they were there before.
Maybe.
When Lori gets thrown outside, I don't see any mannequins outside anymore. It was wild. Very effective. Just, you know,
oh, yeah, it's tension building. One of my favorite callbacks in the movie. But yeah, I think what's so cool is we set up a different expectation, because once she hits that first door button and you see what she's doing, and you're like, oh, it kind of changes the attitude, because, you know, I like how they have this idea that like one's hunter and one's prey, and they're both afraid of being the other.
Yeah.
And
you also have Karen saying that she grew up in a cage. She grew up in a cage,
which has a great payoff at the end, which honestly, like, one of the singular best moments of the franchise.
So let's just get to it, because you've got, so Lori and Michael are fighting. Michael seems to have the upper hand. Allison has entered the house. Karen hears her. She opens the basement. She gets her down, closes the basement. They don't know what Lori's situation is yet, but they do know that Jason, good Lord, that Michael knows where they are and is trying to trying to get to them. And
right.
And she and she is going through all of these different things. And, you know, she sees a gun on the wall that she's prepared, that she hesitantly, like shaking, grabs. And the gun has a lightning bolt carved into
KS.
It. And KS, meaning this is her gun that she was trained from childhood to use.
It's just, this movie does a wonderful job of like adding some like amazing like storytelling like context without like, there's no big flashback. I mean, we've had a couple, but like when she sees that, we know what she's been through. And so we know what this thing means. And I think it's just really fantastic visual storytelling that they've done throughout this movie.
Yeah. And Michael, he knows where they are, and he's ripping the whatever the hearth thing is in the kitchen island that covered that covered that. And he rips it off.
All right. So I know historically, like your franchise killers are really good at finding people. I feel Michael was a little too keen on this island contraption.
I mean, he's heard it now. He's seen it. Like, I feel like this is he not hadn't new seen information.
It. He hadn't seen it.
But I mean, it was
every single
noise.
Time because I know I was thinking the same thing. Because I was like, surely he heard that. But like, you see where he is, and you're like, oh no, there's no way.
I don't know. Maybe there's a deleted scene that explains it. But
well, like he looks at the ground, so I'm assuming he saw like some scrape marks or something.
I mean, he had been shot through the floor earlier, so he knows there's something down there, and he hasn't found another entrance for it.
We don't know how like much he scoped the place out in terms of the what door goes where, but still, yeah, that's fair.
Fair. But my absolute favorite scene in the movie, one of my favorite horror movie scenes I think I may have ever seen. Michael has ripped the kitchen island off, and he's staring down at Karen and Allison.
Now you're combining the names.
Yeah. Karen and Allison, and Karen with the gun in her hand, just shaking, screaming for her mom. I can't do this. I can't do this. I can't do this. And then Michael just kind of stops and looks like he's about to go. And then she says, gotcha. Pops him.
it's such a great scene, but also like, you know, compliments to her because the way she's able to like just have that complete facial change.
Judy Greer nailed it.
She does such a wonderful job. Because you know, you're still wondering what her journey is. And as soon as that moment happens, like you have this direct connection with her mom and everything she's learned and what she knows this place is, because Allison and Karen get out. Michael's trying to, you know, use Taranek, you know, Karen's leg, trying to drag her back in. Allison stabs Michael and then causes him to, I think she cuts his like,
slices his arm enough that he lets go. He can't grab with the other hand because he doesn't have a thumb on that hand anymore. And he falls down into the basement.
And then you come to find out this place wasn't a prison for anyone inside. It was a trap for Michael.
And Lori hits a button and all of a sudden these spikes come across to block Michael in the basement, and all of a sudden you hear this hiss from around the house, and you get all these different spots in the house that, and right next to these big heating elements that are heating up, and she pulls out this road flare. Goodbye, Michael. Throws it down. Everything catches fire.
No, this movie I think kind of has a perfect ending. The finale has a little bit of a reference to the ending of Texas Chainsaw Massacre with you know, them waving down a truck, and you see them just kind of like breathing for the first time as Michael burns in the basement. I think this movie has a perfect ending. I think that they certainly didn't really have a plan for any sequels, and those sequels prove that no matter how you feel about them. This movie ended a specific way, and it's like, nah, this could have been it.
They left it open enough that there's a post-credit sequence that is just darkness and Michael Myers inside the mask breathing sound.
Right.
Which is, you know, whatever.
I mean, they're always going to have something like that, but I love the way this movie ends. You don't get too many of these currently, and it feels good to, you know, bring back a classic, you know, a modern classic movie monster in a great fashion, and then just let that be it. This movie just, I think, has a perfect finish for what they were wanting to do. And who knows to the team that they didn't think, oh, the Pineapple Express guys, they can't make a Halloween film. They did, and they did it with John Carpenter doing the music. I think this is one of the best sequels of the franchise. I have some that I might favor a little bit more, but I love this movie. It's such a fun companion to the first film.
I loved it. I thought it was great. Like, its weaknesses to me are like just the one scene and the teen stuff that doesn't quite go far enough. But just really mostly because I just wanted that one kid to get stabbed and he didn't.
You wanted both of them to get stabbed, really.
The other one, well, I was fine, yeah,
well,
with the other one.
Well, the other one, you know, becomes until the quote unquote nice guy
until he earns the stabbing.
Yeah,
but no, this was a really, really fun movie, a really great one, and one I could see revisiting, and one that I'm really happy to have closed out our Halloween season with.
Yeah, I mean, it's like I said, it's always fun to end the Halloween season with a Halloween film. I typically watch the first one almost every single Halloween. I watch this movie at some point during the month, and I kick off every fall with the opening of Halloween 4, John Michael Myers. But yeah, I think that's what's so great about franchise horror is that, like, it can push some boundaries, but it's still under this interesting thing where, like, it's mainstream enough that, like, everyone is watching it. So you have this idea of, yeah, this is what teens are going to watch. I mean, these franchises are associated with teenagers anyway. So, like, you know, while we begin doing stuff like Trunk or Treat, you know, you always have to, like, kind of at some point get to the point where these kids are going to be watching these things at friends' houses. And like I did, and like a lot of people did. Maybe not horror movies, but I'm sure you watch stuff that maybe you wouldn't have watched at home, or like your parents were like, wouldn't have let you rented, yeah, somewhere else.
That's fair. So yeah, man, love this. Way better than I expected. Way better than Puppet Master 3.
Whoa. let's not say things we don't. Yeah, so it's a bummer for me because, like, this month was so stunted for me, but, like, this was a good rebound. I feel like this was a lot of fun. We'll probably revisit, like, some sort of franchise like this again, maybe for a fall deep dive in the future. But we're gonna switch gears for November. Drew, tell us, what are we doing next week and next month?
So, for the next few weeks, and I say few weeks because we're going to have some other, like, holidays and things like that that may get in the way of being able to record. I don't know yet. We'll see. But Miles and I started the conversation about this, really talking about, you know, well we want to focus on video games. We want to do something that we hadn't really, you know, done in a while, or done, you know, in a minute. And we started talking about, you know, things we're thankful for, like games that we're thankful for. And while that would have been a fun idea, I think it really led me to think, like, man, I would have been thankful to have played this game back in the day. And that's really led us to sort of we'll have a better name for it next week, but sort of a missed connection, a missed the boat on.
I think the name's fine.
I mean, I like puns, so so basically it's going to be a section where we talk about games that we didn't get to play back in the day, and we're going to try to play them. Now, again, video games are video games, and sometimes if there's an 150-hour video game that we're trying to squeeze in amongst all the other stuff we have going on, we might only get a taste of it. Like when we talked about the Super Sentai shows and we only watched 3 episodes of that sort of thing. But I have chosen, and believe it or not, Miles, one of my Halloween themed special episodes that I did not get to record because you happened to get internet access back. Has led me to the first choice. This is a game from 1996. It was released on computer and made full use of this fancy new technology called full motion video. This game is Star Trek Borg. Star Trek Borg. The microphone did not pick you up, so.
Oh no! I'm just excited about it.
Star Trek Borg was a game where you were Q showed up to send you back in time, your player character back in time to the Battle of Wolf 359, which is one of the biggest battles in Star Trek history. It is where 39 Starfleet ships went up against one Borg cube and all of them were destroyed. And he is basically tasking you to, I believe, save your father. And it plays out as you make choices and different full motion videos happen on screen. And sometimes this happens and sometimes that happens. This was a game that I never got to play back in the day. Because I didn't think it came out on my platform of choice. As I look at this Wikipedia page about it, it says that it did come out on my platform of choice, which makes me very, very angry that I never got to play it. But how do you play it today? Well, there is a fan that has basically created, he's recreated the entire game in a web browser. And he's also remastered some of the video files, which is pretty wild, too. The website is borgremastered.com, where you can play, and hopefully this works, we'll see, where you can play the game Star Trek Borg in a web browser. And that's what we're going to be doing for next week.
That's awesome. I'm super, super excited. I honestly, that is not the game I thought you were going to be talking about.
I know you didn't. When I said full motion video, I saw you like, and no, I'm not doing the other one, Night Trap.
Oh, that's not what I was thinking either.
Sewer Shark?
Phantasmagoria.
Oh, I don't even know that one.
It was a popular point and click horror game from that time.
That's going to be it for this week. Check us out next week when we talk about Star Trek Borg. Trying to keep it a little spooky for exiting October.
No, that's awesome. The Borg are also always scary. And I feel like there's a lot of like Borg themed computer games in the 90s.
The Star Trek Elite Force video games, because they focused on Star Trek Voyager. There was some Borg stuff in there. Those were on, what were they on, the Unreal Engine or the Quake 3 engine back in the day? I don't remember what engine
they were on. That sounds about right.
Anyway, this is where we're going to say goodbye for this week. If you'd like to reach out to us, you can find us at themoreyounerd.com, where you can find this and every other episode we've ever done. You can tweet to us at themoreyounerd. You can go to facebook.com/themoreyounerd. And of course, you can email us themoreyounerd@gmail.com. That's themoreyounerd@gmail.com. And of course, you can check out our other show, Cosmic Crit, which is our role play game for the Starfinder RPG put out by Paizo. It's like D&D in space. It's super awesome. CosmicCrit.com. And go there and join the Cosmic Crit Discord, where you can talk to me and Miles all day while we're bored at work. So with that said, gang, we're going to end the show now, as we always do, with a rousing nerd
out. Do nerd for y'all.